We're very fortunate to have as our wrap-up speaker Kevin Sullivan, who is the director of the White House Office of Communications. And he's going to talk to us about a variety of aspects of the persuasion operation of the White House publicity units. I often break it down into persuasion and information between the press office and the and the communications office, and long term daily as the differences between them too. Yeah. So you have a very interesting history as to how you got into to the White House. Your route to the White House was different than anyone I think I've come across, and I can see how it would work for you. You worked for the Dallas Mavericks for 12 years?
18.
Well, can you tell us how you got into publicity and what the similarities are in sports and in the White House?
There's lots of them. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. It's nice to be back. Thanks for coming, you guys. Hello, Towson. So I'm like the only thing standing. Am I like the only thing standing between these guys and like summer vacation? Is that kind of the deal?
Well, how many more classes do you all have? Are you?
Okay. That's not so bad. Though. I thought you were really going to be antsy.
System. No, with Towson, that's true. Today's the last class at Towson. Yeah, and they're there too.
Well, good luck in finals and all that stuff. So. My story is an oddball one in terms of the White House or politics, for that matter. I started right out of college. I went to Purdue University. I worked in the athletic department. I wanted to get involved in sports. Hustled my way into a job in way back in 1980 with the Dallas Mavericks. I was 21 years old. I always tell people on my first day on the job, I worked until 11 o'clock at night. I didn't want to leave. They were going to have to bodily remove me every day from the office, because it was like a dream come true. And I really had sort of, at the age of 21, there I was kind of doing what I always dreamed about doing. But interestingly, people end up in sports communications because they love sports more than they love communications, I think. It's just sort of a way in for a lot of people. And I enjoyed the communication stuff. But I was there a long time. I went to NBC Sports after 18 years with the Mavericks. I was in New York for 5+ years. The last 6 months of which I was on the corporate side with NBC Universal. The merger had happened between NBC and Universal. The company doubled in size, and I took advantage of that opportunity to broaden my career by going onto the corporate side. But interestingly, sports communications is a corporate. Even when I was with the Mavericks, it was all about selling tickets and doing what you could to support the efforts of the business enterprise. So. But the way I ended up in the administration was the total fluke. It was kind of a mutual friend that I had in common with Secretary Margaret Spellings from my Dallas days put us together. And I had never heard of her. I didn't know anything about any of this. But she wanted to go outside of government to find somebody, the head of communications at the Department of Education, for a lot of reasons that I won't bore you with. But she was intrigued by hiring somebody that was a little non-traditional. And I had almost no interest. I was 6 months into this new job on the corporate side, 3 months actually, but when she first contacted me. It was going great. I was getting to do new things. I was learning a lot. I had just attended the premiere of the movie The Interpreter. Nicole Kidman and Sean Penn, Robert De Niro were all there, sitting right in front of us. I told my wife, this is the big time. And next thing I knew, we were moving to Washington to go to work at the U.S. Department of Education, of all places. As you can imagine, the people at NBC didn't know what I was thinking. Couldn't imagine why I would do that, but in meeting with Secretary Spellings, her pitch to me was as follows. She looked at me. We met for lunch. She looked at me across the table and said, "I don't know what you'll do after NBC, but this will be the most important thing you've done so far. I'm putting a team together. It's going to be fun. You're going to love the president. It'll be good for your family. You'll always be in the room. I won't make a move without you. What do you say? I need the help." And I just, the thing about doing something important and meaningful really did appeal to me. After working in television for 5.5 years, it was great. It was not important. It was really more about money for NBC and publicity for the executives and that sort of thing. And so that appeal did resonate with me, and I kind of jumped off the cliff. My wife was all for it. We have 4 kids. So it was a big undertaking, you know, to not a decision, obviously, to make lightly. And I was here about 2 weeks. This is 3 weeks ago, 3 years ago, I should say. It was like 3 years ago last week is what I was trying to say. But
you lose track of time.
You do. Time flies.
That's because you never get out.
I don't. And so after I was there a couple of weeks, I knew it was the right thing to do, and it was a great career challenge. I had 140 people I was responsible for in communications and outreach at the department. So from a management leadership standpoint, it was a big challenge. And it was fun. And after being there about 13 months, the White House called, and I've been there. July will be 2 years. So it is a little bit of an oddball deal, but the skills are the same. They are transferable from one field to another. It takes a little bit of time to learn the substance, but you know, most people in communications, I think, are naturally curious, and I certainly am, and I worked hard to pick it up as quickly as I could. A lot of similarities between sports and in the White House. You when you work for a team, you know, the Mavericks, we had some good years and some really bad years, and through thick and thin, you know, sports and politics, you've got fans who jump on and off the bandwagon. They vote at the box office, just like you would at the ballot box in politics. Uh-huh. There's a what have you done for me lately kind of mentality. But I think the number one similarity is that, you know, just like with a candidate or, in our case, the president, and a team, you know, you really do have to believe in the cause. You know, you pull for the team through thick and thin. There's an emotional roller coaster of up and downs, you know, with life with a pro team. And also, it's you're part of something that the community is really invested in and really cares about. It feels passionately about good and bad. You know, when I was at the Mavericks, our best player, kind of toward the end, was Jason Kidd. We traded him. People went nuts. You know, same kind of thing when you make a decision about a policy or something in government, people feel strongly about it. So a lot of similarities.
Uh-huh. What do you do when you know that the trade is going to take place? Just turn off your BlackBerry for a while?
You have to plan. You know, you have to. What are we going to say about this? How are we going to explain it? People would say to me, "Well, what do you think of that trade?" Well, my opinion is not what matters at that moment. There's a time and a place for my opinion, my personal view, but at that moment, I'm speaking on behalf of the ownership and the management of the team, and I have to explain why we traded Jamal Mashburn, you know, for Mike or Jimmy Jackson or Jason Kidd, whatever the deal was there. We made a bunch of them in a hurry when Don Nelson came in as the new GM of the team. He got rid of everybody. And some of the deals, there was no good explanation for them. They were done for reasons, just get these guys out of here kind of reasons. And so that was a challenge. And again, it kind of reinforces that it's the same kind of thing that we do now at the White House, where you plan, you know, how are we going to manage this announcement? How are we going to roll out this new policy, whatever it is? And you pull together all the different components of it and make it work. Mm-hmm. Sometimes better than others.
Uh-huh. What are some of the challenges, just like, say, explaining some of the trades? What are some of the challenges? I wouldn't say that they were exactly similar, but
right.
Things that also, you know, took some doing to work on, that you had kind of a hostile, a hostile audience, or you knew that it was going to be difficult. And what do you do in that kind of instance?
You know, immigration, comprehensive immigration reform comes to mind. You know, the president, around a year ago, around this time, it was hot and heavy. And we knew that for conservatives, especially, this was an unpopular policy. The president knew that it was a risky thing to take on from that standpoint. But he really believes in it and had the political will to do it, even if the Congress ultimately didn't. So that was one that took a careful. We had multiple audiences. In fact, on some days, we were getting hit from both the left and the right. And we actually had a strategy to deal with both kinds of attacks. We engaged in blogs for the first time at the White House in the name of the White House. And we just had to be a little bit more creative with how we talked about it, knowing that it was going to be an uphill battle. And since then, we really now have the headwind of the 08 campaigns to deal with, where you have to be creative. It has to be newsy. In order to break through, given all the interest in the hot political season right now.
So one of the things that that you all seem to be doing this year reminds me of what Eisenhower did in his last year, because he had a Democratic Congress to deal with. And so what he did is James Hagerty, who was his press secretary, but he also did communications. I mean, he really had the concept of planning. So he had written him a memo before that last year and suggested that his last year that he traveled the world as a man of peace. And it would be kind of a wrap-up to much of what he was doing. And so I noticed that every month you all are traveling. It seems that you're traveling around the world.
Eight foreign trips, I believe it is, this year, Martha. But the one thing I would say is, if you look at each of the trips, they're not really valedictory. You know, I'm going to go take a bow in Africa, for example. The reason the president had a phenomenally successful Africa trip, and we could talk about the communications around that if you like, because there were some interesting things that we did there, too, different from other trips. But he wanted to go for a reason, because the president's emergency AIDS relief program, PEPFAR as it's known, is due to be reauthorized. So it was very important for the president, Mrs. Bush, to go to Africa, remind the American people, you know, the audience, the message was directed, you know, at the people in America, remind them, look at the lives that we've saved, look at the people that we've helped, you know, through the generosity of the American taxpayers. And this, and as the president talks a lot about, to whom much is given, much is required, and you know, we want to make sure this gets reauthorized. Now the House has passed it. We now need to work with the Senate to get it passed, mm-hmm. and then fully reauthorized. You know, the trip to Eastern Europe was mostly about the NATO summit, missile defense, meeting with Putin to make sure that the handoff to Medvedev was handled in a certain way. You know, kind of wrap up with Putin and the outstanding mm-hmm. issues that were there. And work on missile defense. So it's not like it's just sort of a sightseeing tour to take a bow from a legacy standpoint. Middle East peace, the president just left. You know, we put the volleyball net up in the West Wing, and the grown-ups are gone for a week. But the president literally just departed a few minutes ago to go on a second trip to the Middle East, again, driving the peace process, you know, not to go, you know, take a bow for having gotten it started, but to try to finish it off. So there's real substance in these foreign trips as well.
Yeah. Well, in Eisenhower's, he had some, too. He was to be meeting with, one of the things he was doing was meeting with Khrushchev, although the U-2 incident occurred, and
right.
that meeting did not take place. The Africa policy has been interesting, because it's been very successful in Africa, and Bush has committed more money, has brought more money into Africa than any president before him, including Bill Clinton. Yet, it's not something that has been high on the scope here of people, of news organizations. They didn't
right.
give it much attention. The trip, they gave it more with the trip. But why do you think that's so? Why has it been difficult to explain the Africa policy, and what did you do with this trip to try to do that?
You know, I think one of the problems is it's really far away, and you know, there are issues mm-hmm. right in front of us here, and that's a careful line to balance. But you know, the things that we did working with the press office to communicate a little bit differently around this trip, you know, we agreed for the president to be interviewed by Bob Geldof for Time magazine, ended mm-hmm. up in phenomenal coverage in two issues of Time, including some things online. You know, Geldof, of course, an activist, and you know, used to be known as a rocker, you know, back mm-hmm. in the 80s, but has really become a preeminent advocate for issues in Africa over the years, and wrote about it as a journalist for Time. That ended up as a, you know, it was a little bit risky. The president had met him before. We didn't know how it was going to turn out. We knew he was generally supportive of the president's efforts, but you know, we didn't know. Here's a guy who's not really full-time a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that paid dividends. We did an interesting thing. There were the president gave a speech at the Museum of African American Art before departing for Africa to set up what his goals were and kind of the ambitions of the trip, and again reinforce the message for the domestic audience. And then we had set up a speech on the back end of the trip. He actually received an award from the Lewis Sullivan Foundation for his work with Africa. And we thought it'd be an opportunity to recap for the American audience what had been achieved. But the thing that happened in between was that, you know, the White House photographers are really extraordinarily talented. And we kept seeing these images on our website during the course of the week. And somewhere along the line, somebody suggested to the president, you know, we could do an old-fashioned slideshow at the Sullivan Foundation in receiving that award. And what started out as an idea of 20 to 30 slides became 111. And it became a video that we posted on our website that got emailed around to our, you know, our big friends and family list. It ended up on YouTube. The RNC did some things with it. I mean, it really ended up getting widely distributed. And it was the president narrating these 111 slides. It was the speech he gave laid over. It took some post-production work, but we combined these slides with his speech and made a real nice video presentation out of it that we got tons of feedback on. And still is on the WhiteHouse.gov site if you're interested in taking a look at it. So we tried, you know, he did an interview with Ann Curry of the Today Show live from Africa one morning with Mrs. Bush. So we just tried to, knowing that we had to be a little bit more creative to drive the message.
How do you gauge the success of your various communications operations, like something like that?
You know, some are measurable, like hits on the website or page views on the website. Other ones, you know, you get feedback just sort of anecdotally that's not, you know, driven by hard data. You hear people talking about it. You hear other reporters following up. It's an inexact science. I mean, certain things can be measured, but generally speaking, what we do is inexact. You kind of go, you know, you have to rely to a certain extent on anecdotal evidence.
Do you, as part of gauging success of normal operations, not maybe this one, but domestic things, do you all watch the evening news together? And do you like your office, people in your office?
No, we don't watch it together, but we watch it, and we get the transcripts on email right afterwards. We see the press office puts out a little summary of what the top stories were on all the networks. You know, the regional clips from all around the country often are the better barometer. You know, the president was in St. Louis a week ago Friday to do a town hall on the economy. And the coverage, the national coverage, was more about, did he use the word recession or not? What words did he use? How did he describe it? It was really almost a process story on how the president, what words he chose. But in St. Louis and in the state of Missouri, the coverage was completely different. And there's a lot of value in that regional coverage.
Sure.
You know, so we monitor it from a regional basis, too, not just an inside the Beltway or a national perspective.
So one of the new tools that there is shadow TV.
Right.
So... So do you look at, say, the clips of the evening news from St. Louis, from all the different ones?
You know, we don't do shadow TV on the local telecasts every single time, but occasionally we will, and we'll go to their websites and see what they did. You know, it's more picking it off the TV websites for the locals and the regionals. Occasionally we'll shadow them, but. Well, we always use shadow TV for the networks.
After the presentation at the Leon Sullivan Awards, the president did an interview with April Ryan, who works for American Urban Radio Networks. And so she was saying that in talking to him, because they didn't do the interview until they got back to the Oval Office, she was telling him about the coverage of his visit to Baltimore. He had gone to a halfway house that I think
Jericho
was,
program, right?
Yeah, so he had gone
prisoner reentry is what it was.
Yeah, and so she was telling him that all the local networks used it on their local news, and so she was telling him about what they had said, what the individuals had said. And it was very positive, and he was unaware of it, and he was you know, glad to hear about it, but he was unaware of it. And I wondered if you all go over with him sometimes what, in a sense, why you do this. What kind of coverage do you get out of it?
He doesn't typically. What will happen is if we're on the road, like in the cases of St. Louis or the Baltimore, the Jericho event. You know, if we're on Air Force One, he'll come back to the conference room and he'll say, "How's it playing out there?" You know, and I remember one day we were in Kansas City doing, and this is a great lesson for young communications people. We were in Kansas City after the State of the Union in 07, and we were doing a healthcare event. And we got back on the plane after the event, and he came back in and said, "How's it playing out there? What are they saying?" And I said, "Well, the way it's playing today, Mr. President, is the DNA came back on Anna Nicole's baby." And so healthcare in Kansas City. Now it did get local coverage, of course, but from the afternoon cable news coverage was completely blown away. So sometimes the things that are completely out of your control really do sort of rule the day. But he will ask, you know, how's it going? How's it playing? What are they saying? Anything that we need to go back on? But he doesn't obsess about it. He's not he doesn't drill down that deep. But he does have a natural curiosity about. You know, how is it playing? And so we do talk about it with him.
the day that Anna Nicole Smith died, one of the people who works in radio, after the announcement came, he came out and he said, "Well, everybody can go home." Because there's not going to be anything coming out of the White House. There's not a news organization that's going to care. It's all going to be going to be her.
I'll say another one. It's kind of a similar thing. We had the drug czar. It's the Office of National Drug Control Policy, a guy named John Walters, and they do some great work. And they have, every year they have an ad campaign, and it had been several years, and the ad campaign has been very successful, and they've documented the drop in teen drug use and other categories that they've targeted with their ad campaign. Well, this year they were going to segue into prescription drugs, which is the one drug that's going up. Well, the thing that, and for the first time in 4 or 5 years, they were going to advertise in the Super Bowl. So we internally cooked up this idea for the president to do a, and again, going back to my NBC days, do a sneak preview like you would do for Super Bowl advertisers, in New York City, show reporters what you would do for Super Bowl for media reporters with Super Bowl advertisers. Here's the big ads that are going to be. So we thought, well, let's have the president and the drug czar, John Walters, do a preview of this year's ad campaign right before the Super Bowl, including the ad that is going to be shown for the first time in the Super Bowl. And the ONDCP communicators had a rollout plan that would kind of follow. They were going to bring some reporters in and do some other activities with mm-hmm. Director Walters. Well, the day before the event, Heath Ledger is found dead of an overdose. So we had to huddle up, including, with the president, to say, how is this going to appear? What is this going to look like? And even though we had it planned in advance, and it obviously had nothing to do with the unfortunate death of Heath Ledger, we felt it would kind of look in bad taste for us to, it would look like it was piling on. It would look like we were trying to capitalize, on that tragedy. So we canceled the event, So you just have to be flexible. You've got to be, always be kind of aware of what's going on in the world to know what kind of impact your announcement might have, on other people. So mm-hmm. you really are at the mercy of these sort of outside events.
How many kind of operations do you have going on at the same time? Various types of planning that you're doing, and how do you organize it? Do you have this is what we're going to call long range, medium range, short range?
It's really done more by we always have long range planning going on, and that's about a 4 to 6 week window, and it starts out like right now the economy is without question the number one issue. It used to be Iraq. And when we look at the calendar, we start out with, okay, each week we need to make sure we're talking about the economy at least once, often twice. And talking about the economy can mean anything from a full-blown speech to, a statement when the jobs numbers come out, the unemployment numbers. It can be a roundtable with small business people. It can be a lot of different things, some of which are more demanding on the president's time than others. So we kind of start with that. What about, Iraq? What else? But now the economy is subdivided by housing, healthcare. There's other components of it that are really mm-hmm. top of mind. So we have people assigned to each of these policy buckets, and so we're planning at the same time. We're planning along lines housing, generally the economy, FISA, which is the terror surveillance law, is about to be back on the front burner, the medium burner with Congress. That will get reactivated as an issue that we're tracking over with a communications plan over the next few weeks. And we'll kind of go from there.
Do you have communications people with policy people?
All the time. It's been one of the strengths of this administration. The way policy gets made, there's a process that has it starts with the deputies, which means kind of the assistants to the policy heads. Well, in that deputies process, my deputy, now Terry Tiber, and her staff are included at the deputies level. And then as it goes along and as policy gets developed, there are principals meetings, which means the cabinet members and the assistants to the president for each of the various areas of responsibility, including the different policy areas, are all gathered around a table. Dana Perino is in those meetings. I'm in those meetings. Ed Gillespie, the counselor to the president. We're all in those meetings. So as policy is being cooked, all through the process, communications people are in there. And it's really a must because we can, with our ear to the ground, talking to reporters, knowing kind of how things will play, we can head off, I think, mistakes sometimes, even if mistakes of what could be policy that's a little bit flawed in terms of how it would be publicly received, or in terms of timing. Mm-hmm. You know, now is not the right time to roll this out. So, you know, we're involved every step of the way.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes can drive policy decisions.
Uh-huh. How many people, say, in the deputies' meetings, what offices are involved, and how many people come together in those deputies' meetings?
You know, every office. I mean, there's representation, depending on what the policy is, but you would have, the press office, the communications office would be represented, and then, you know, the vice president has a representative in mm-hmm. there. Then, you know, if there's any, the National Economic Council, you would have the domestic policy would be represented. You know, every kind of area of responsibility would be represented.
So would you have political affairs and public liaison?
Public liaison would be in everything because they do the outreach right. to the various stakeholder groups and everything.
And Ledge Affairs.
Political affairs wouldn't be. Ledge Affairs is in everything because Ledge yeah. Affairs, you know, they work with Congress. There's always going to be an element, of impact to Congress. So they're in all those meetings. Political affairs wouldn't necessarily be.
Uh-huh. So that's the planning, say, four to 6 weeks out?
Sometimes longer on certain things, yeah. especially now. You know, we're getting down, we've got 8 or 9 months left, and we know these certain trips that are already there uh-huh. that are laid out. So we've looked a little bit farther down the road than we normally. But normally it's about a six-week. We always try to be, you know, kind of booking, you know, 6 weeks ahead.
What about the State of the Union? Can you talk about the preparations for that? When do they begin, and when do the themes developed? And is it related to the budget? Do the two of them come
sure.
together at the beginning?
State of the Union, you know, normally about the third week of January, the budget comes out the first week of February, so there's always going to be connectivity between mm-hmm. the budget process and what you call for, what the president calls for, and the State of the Union. Fascinating process. It starts around the first conversations the president would have with the speechwriters would be probably around Thanksgiving. The president is incredibly hands-on when it comes to speeches, big and small. Bill McGurn, who recently departed as the president's chief speechwriter, used to say he's the commander-in-chief, but for us, he's the editor-in-chief. And it's really true. He's incredibly hands-on. So he would start talking about the themes he had in mind in that kind of holiday period, mm-hmm. you know, between Thanksgiving and Christmas time, first of the year, and would sit down and would talk about an outline of the themes with the writers. This year it was basically empower people. We're going to trust people, you know, on a variety of areas with their health care, with their money, which would relate to his policy on keeping taxes low, that sort of thing. So it starts really, you know, November, December, and then it heats up as we get closer to December. A little bit of a break around the holidays, but not much. The writers all worked over the holiday period. And the president would see a draft probably around the end of the first week of January, and then it's full on from there. And meanwhile, there's policy meetings going on to deal with what's going to be in the State of the Union concurrently. And the speech goes through 35 or 40 drafts. You know, normal speech might mm-hmm. have 10 or 15. And a draft can be a really small change, so that's not necessarily indicative. But and there's the president rehearses it several times. And there's a process going along with who are Mrs. Bush's guests that night. Now, this year, the president chose not to call out the guest in the box. It's sort of become almost a cliched mm-hmm. you know, device that's used at the State of the Union, kind of like these people just happen to be here. So this year, we didn't do it, just to kind of change it up a little bit.
Uh-huh. You had guests.
We had guests,
yeah,
but we didn't.
Guests.
And the guests were there, and the regional media, all their hometown newspapers were told that they were there and why they were there. And we did, you know, they did some media around it, so there was awareness that they were there. But the president didn't mention them during the course of the speech.
Uh huh. There was a reception beforehand.
Reception beforehand in the White House.
Uh huh. In looking at the State of the Union, when do the policy groups come in?
Starts really in the fall. Uh-huh. I mean, that gets going, you know, early. Now, this year was different because we knew we weren't going to be rolling out, you know, a lot of new policy in the final year. But last year, you know, we were on a track with, there was new health care policy, there was new energy policy, comprehensive immigration reform was mentioned. You know, so there were three or four different, you know, policy buckets that were ongoing throughout the fall leading up to the State of the Union.
How do you then, after the State of the Union is over, what process do you have for following the items that he mentioned and what their status is during the year? And then how do you go out and dramatize each of those during the year?
Well, you know, in the case of 07, the day after the State of the Union, we went to Delaware and did an energy event where the president talked about biofuels, mm-hmm. and it was at Dow Chemical, and you know, pretty substantial speech following on, expanding on what was in the State of the Union. And then the next day was that healthcare event in Kansas City. And we went the next 3 or 4 days out into the country to talk about what the president announced would work. In the case of this year, that event, the prisoner reentry event in Baltimore, was the first post-State of the Union event. And then the next day we went out on the road and traveled and did some follow-up events with the items that the president laid out. You know, so it's a matter of, and then you're tracking with Congress, and it becomes a matter of legislative affairs to track. And you'll hear the president on housing, for example. I know you want to talk about the rapid response. One of the devices mm-hmm. we can use is, you know, the president called for this in 05 or 06 or 07, and it still hasn't been done. You know, it's always something you can go back to monitor what kind of traction mm-hmm. it's gained or hasn't gained.
One of the operations that you all developed in the second term has been the rapid response operation that came out of the campaign. And can you tell us how it works and how you gauge the success of that one?
The way the day, you know, the best way to probably lay it out is just to talk about how the day goes at the White House a little bit. Starts at 7:30 a.m. is the senior staff meeting. About 20 people in the Roosevelt Room. And the very first thing, the chief of staff, Josh Bolton, runs the meeting. The first person he calls on is Melissa Bennett, who runs the president's schedule. And she will, everybody in the meeting has a card, kind of like this one right here, that has the president's schedule on it. And Melissa will start out by mentioning any changes in the schedule, but she'll call attention to the public events. Here's what the president's doing today. And so right from the very first, the moment that your day begins at 7:30, we're talking about the president's, you know, public activities for that day. After Melissa's little readout, the first person who's called on in the meeting is Dana Perino, our press secretary. And Dana will click through the big stories of the day, because that's what all of us are going to be dealing with. And if you're a policy, you know, if you're the head of the president's economic council, and there's a big story about housing on the front page of all the papers, that is showing you, you know, this is something we got to be dealing with. You know, so it's a natural sort of first alert system for mm-hmm. everybody. We depart that meeting at 8 o'clock. It almost never lasts longer than a half an hour. Having been in the corporate world, I can tell you that a Bush White House, you know, as the first NBA president, is an efficient operation when it comes to starting on time, knowing why you're meeting. The president often begins meetings by saying, "What's the purpose of the meeting? You know, is it because we have a decision to make? Is you know what is the reason why we're doing this?" So 8 o'clock, the senior staff meeting ends, and we go up to Ed Gillespie's office, and we have a communicators meeting, and it's all hands on deck. It's the media affairs people who report to Jeannie Mamo. It's Dana's crew from the press office. It's Terry Tiber's crew from the communications office. There'll be representation there from Mrs. Bush's office, from the vice president, from the Office of Management and Budget, all the way down the line. Adam Belmar, who runs our production group, will be there. And we go through, you know, what's the plan for today? What's the plan for this week? You know, and again, Dana will repeat for the benefit of those not in senior staff, here's the news of the day. Here's what we're going to be pushing back on. Here's what didn't go the way we planned it. Here's what worked pretty well. And then we'll talk a little bit long term in that meeting, or, you know, but mostly it's what's the plan for this, for today and for this week? What documents do we need? Is there something we need to push back on in terms of rapid response? Is there something coming up, like the Middle East trip, that we need to do a little better job of setting the table on? You know, so it is an all hands on deck every single day, you know, at 8 o'clock, to make sure we're clicking in the right direction and we're all pulling together, and then it kind of goes from there.
Uh-huh. Are there any representatives from the departments and agencies there?
The departments and agencies are handled separately with a conference call. Each of Dana Perino's deputies are assigned agencies that they work with, and they have a call every single day with their respective agencies. So if it's on the economic stuff, we've been a constant communication with the president's economic team. So that pulls in Treasury, Housing and Urban Development, you know, sometimes small business, obviously commerce and labor. they're always talking all the time. And then on the communications front, we do that regularly as well. Mm-hmm. And we also have a call Mondays and Fridays at 11 o'clock that Scott Stanzel and I do, Scott is one of the deputy press secretaries, with Hill Communicators. So we make sure we're knitted up with them. So, you know, it's all designed to kind of work together.
How many people from the Hill are in that conference call?
That particular call is with leadership, Republican leadership.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Is it principals or staff?
Staff.
Uh-huh.
It'd be the press secretaries and the communications directors that are affiliated with Republican leadership on the Hill.
Uh-huh. And what kinds of information do you give them and get from them?
You know, it's helpful for us to know, you know, like on an issue like the terror surveillance bill or the war supplemental, which will be a big budget thing that's about to happen. They know better than us, you know, often, you know, on the minute-by-minute changes. When is it going to be on the floor? You know, what are you hearing about this? You know, are we going to have veto sustaining strength on the farm bill, for example, which is one that's in the wheelhouse right now? You know, so we get information from them, and as well, we're able to tell them, here's what the president's talking about this week. It's a little bit of a read ahead for them of his schedule.
One of the things the rapid response operation does, in a way, you could look at it as doing offense and defense.
Right.
And so if people, like say on the Hill or elsewhere, may be missing something that the president's doing on an individual day, they put in an email, it's in very brief form, kind of the nut. What was it the president said, and what were the supporting information, and what background information there is on if it's a major speech. If somebody wrote an editorial in the Wall Street Journal and people might not have seen it, that's an indication you missed it.
Right.
And so those are kind of offense.
I'll give you a couple examples. The farm bill, which is sort of an inside the beltway deal, until you get to the ag community, and then it really, there are tons of stakeholders and constituents for something like this, but it is really one of the most complex pieces of legislation. They do it about every 5 years.
Yeah.
It is a monster. And the president called for, this is the deal where farmers can be subsidized for all kinds of various reasons, and the president called for reforms so that wealthy farmers weren't paid, you know, big subsidies, in some cases not to farm. And, you know, again, it's enormously complicated. It includes everything from, you know, school nutrition programs all the way to energy policy with the biofuel stuff and all that. Well, anyway, it's a tricky thing with our relationship with the Hill because from a political standpoint, it's tough for the senators and the congressmen to be against this for those who represent states and districts that are heavy, you know, ag constituents. So we did a document that came out last Thursday, maybe it was, that just kind of laid out in fact sheet form in plain English. We always try to get the jargon out. One of the things with having the policy people involved in the process, it's important for the communicators to have the last look at it, and then they sign off on it one final time. But we got to take out, to make sure the language is plain. But we just laid out what it is that we don't like and what the president proposed. So even if you didn't know anything about the farm bill or you didn't have that much interest in agriculture, you can look at this and understand why we took the position that we took. So, but that was a preemptive deal. It was definitely on offense, you know, that we just did this week. Today we put out a document at 3:30 advancing the president's trip, recapping all the interviews that he did this week in advance with Middle Eastern reporters, which obviously won't be widely read here. Mm-hmm. But it was a way of, you know, once again, in the president's words, here's the goals. You know, here's why we're going, here's what we hope to accomplish. There's a lot of skepticism about the president's ability mm-hmm. to get this peace deal done. So we're once again kind of banging away at, here's why we think we can make progress on this trip. So always try to be on offense. And before we talk about defense, I even look at the defense as being on offense because we don't approach it from a defensive posture. You know, like the New York Times wrote a story about the president, you know, I just happened to bring this, Martha, because I knew that you wanted to talk about this.
Yeah.
You know, on April 4th, Cheryl Stolberg, who's a fine reporter with the New York Times, wrote a story, and obviously Cheryl doesn't write the headlines, but her White House memo, the headline was, "In economic drama, Bush is largely off stage." Well, the defensive thing would be to just field the calls and be defensive about it and be argumentative But it feels good to, you know, take action. And so we affirmatively, proactively put out a document that took on the flaws in this piece.
I'd say it set her hair on fire.
I like Cheryl a lot. It's not personal.
It was pretty strong.
It was a little spicy, but it's not personal. And I don't think Cheryl took it personally. But, you know, for example, one of the things a couple of the big things that were critical, largely off stage. And we were able to demonstrate in writing that the president, since August of 2007, did a public event on housing 28 times. Well, one of the reasons maybe the New York Times thinks that the president's invisible is because they don't cover these events, including one recently that they chose to highlight in this article that was in Freehold, New Jersey, which happens to be in their, you know, readership area. So we pointed that out, and a couple other things. But it's a way of just not, rather than just, you know, kind of lay back and take it or make a few phone calls, we went public with our dissatisfaction, but fact-based dissatisfaction. It's not, you really have to pick your spots. You can't just, you know, there's an old saying in communications, you're entitled to your own opinion, but not your own facts. So we always try to make these things fact-based, you know, and point out, you know, they took a shot at the president, you know, one of 8 foreign trips he's taking this year. Well, he was at the NATO summit meeting with Putin about missile defense in Eastern Europe, meeting with world leaders from Eastern Europe. Not exactly a frivolous, you know, non-newsy kind of trip. So anyway, you know, and you know, we had sent to Congress a bill in April of 2006 calling for modernization of the FHA, so that more families could qualify for FHA loans. You know, April of 2006, still no action. So we're able to point these things out. And now in this particular case, you say, how do you judge the effectiveness of it? It's not like some reporters took note of it, but it wasn't like there was a lot of follow-up on this. But we still made our point so that next time, the same kind of cheap shot couldn't be levied. The all-time example, I think, for setting the record straight, getting in the reporting, we talked about this last time I was here, I believe, was when Bob Woodward came out with his book, State of Denial. We got an advanced copy of the book. We went through it with a fine-tooth comb. We identified 5 myths that we felt were in the book. We did a document called, you know, 5 Myths About State of Denial by Bob Woodward, and we released it. And so when he was on his book tour, we got it out in advance of the book coming out. And when the excerpt appeared in the Washington Post, the Reuters story about our 5 myths that we identified was right there in the middle of the double truck, you know, excerpt on that Sunday when the Sunday before the Tuesday when the book came out. And sure enough, when Mr. Woodward went on his book tour, in a number of cases, he was asked by reporters, by interviewers on his book tour, well, the White House says you got 5 things wrong in here. And he defended his position on those 5 things, but at least we had planted the seed with people that, you know, Condoleezza Rice wasn't in that meeting. And again, it was fact-based, and we made it as hard-hitting, as concise as we could, so that it would be read and well-received. So being on offense is almost always a good thing, even when you're really kind of doing it from a defensive, you know, posture.
Uh-huh. Now, would you also be accompanying something like setting the record straight with some phone calls, like, say, to Cheryl?
Absolutely. And you know what? There's a lot of stories that we don't like that don't rise to the level of a setting the record straight that have a flaw or that have something that we think is misleading. And, you know, Tony Fratto and Scott Stanzel and Gordon Jandro and Dana Perino will be on the phone with reporters saying, hey, you know, the thing in the third paragraph is just, you know, really misleading. And they'll do that kind of hand-to-hand, you know, action all the time. I mean, all day, every day. And when there are good things, they'll make similar calls. But even when it doesn't rise to the level of a formal document, you know, the press office is managing those stories.
Uh-huh. What's the benefit? Say in Cheryl's case, say somebody called her, and what would they say?
Well, I think the first thing is you want to correct anything that's wrong. You want to point out anything that you think is misleading or incomplete. You know, Cheryl wrote a story. I don't mean to pick on Cheryl. Cheryl wrote a story about a recent trip to Connecticut We did a malaria event, and we did a fundraiser at Henry Kissinger's house. And she wrote about combining the fundraiser with the official event. And we were able to point out that, and she had some Democratic former Clinton political operatives quoted in the story, and didn't include the fact that these guys did exactly the same thing when President Clinton was in office. So that actually was an online-only story, and she did update it. So mm-hmm. in that particular case, the call did result, you know, and because of the online, you know, stories having so much power these days, and so much of what people read is online, you can correct something that may be, you know, updatable or correctable, unlike in the print edition. So that would be it. It wouldn't, again, not personal, but it would be, hey, you know what, you missed the boat on this. You didn't say this about, you know, it's incomplete to leave out the fact that these guys that you're quoting about our event did exactly the same thing, you know, between 1992 and 2000, you know, and that's unfair to not include that. And, you know, so it would be that kind of thing. And it's not with a lot of heat, you know, just kind of pointing out, because you do have relationships with the reporters. Most of the time they're very good. They want to be accurate. They are responsible most of the time, but when they're not, it's important so that it doesn't become accepted as part of conventional wisdom. It's important to go on the record before, and you got to do it quickly, or it will become part of conventional wisdom and just accept it as a fact. You have to make every effort you can to set the record straight.
In Cheryl's first article there that we were talking about the invisible. I think invisible was somewhere in that piece.
Right, in the headline.
In the headline, yeah.
And probably in the lead, but...
Which I think, I'm not sure that it was in the lead. I thought that it might have been a case of a headline writer, but it was in the front page above the fold, and right in the middle. So I wondered if that
was... Yeah, the headline said offstage. Invisible is in the story, though.
In the story, yeah. Remember the word being in.
Right.
Does the president... ever say, you know, that story really made me mad, because he reads newspapers. And, you know, at one time he was trying to tell people that he didn't read newspapers. You know, he said that to Britt Hume, that's what staff is for.
Yeah, he doesn't expend, you know, a lot of time on what's in the newspaper. He reads, you know, like everybody, I think, you know, he reads certain parts of the paper, and other parts not as much. He's interested. He knows what's going on, but it's not something that he's micromanaging or he's really overly concerned with.
So he wouldn't say, you know, I was really packed off about this. And because I remember one day he came into the briefing room and somebody asked him a question about been a story that day in the Washington Post about this must have been in 2002 about. The hijackers, who obviously were long dead, but they had filed some applications. And as it turned out, their applications had been granted. And later, you know, like in 2002. And it was somewhere in the bureaucracy that they didn't recognize who these people were. And I think it was for more flight training or something like that. And so the Post had it. And the president said, I saw that story this morning when I was drinking my coffee and I was so angry. And so you knew, number one, he did read newspapers, and that he did have a strong response to them.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there are times when he'll point out that he, something he read, he felt they got it wrong. But it's not like he's, you know, reading the paper early in the morning and calling, you know, the press office to dispatch him to go correct stuff. He doesn't get involved really at that level. Occasionally he'll say, you know, we ought to fix that, or, you know, what can you do about that? But it's not like that big of a deal day in and day out.
Except when the president points something out, that it becomes a big deal to the state.
Yeah, I mean, occasionally. Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, you know, but see, in that scenario, they would already probably be on it, because they would also know that, you know.
Okay, let's see. Other kinds of aspects of the rapid response operation. What are some of the other things that do you think have been effective, and how do you judge their success?
You know, I would you judge a success by, if you, you talked, you started at the beginning talking about persuasion, you know, and you look for movement in opinion, you know, you look for, and a lot of what we do is in support of the legislative strategy. So if you know, you see some votes move on the Hill, you know, we've done, and this isn't rapid response in the form of a document, but again, on the terror surveillance thing, you know, the blue dogs, the moderate, mm-hmm. you know, Democrats are largely with the administration on the terror surveillance bill. And so when they went home for recess, for the Easter recess, I guess it would have been, we targeted, you know, talk radio in their districts and editorial boards of newspapers in their districts to just make sure that, that while they went home for Easter, they didn't forget that, you know that, and especially, you know, in a deal like the terror surveillance bill, it's unlike housing or gas prices or food prices or whatever. They're not going to go home and they're not going to hear about this at a town hall meeting necessarily. You know, it's not the sort of thing. It's complicated. It's a little known law, you know, but there's reasons why it's really important for our safety here in the U.S. And so we wanted to kind of plant those reminders. So it was very strategic and targeted to try to make sure that those mm-hmm. votes remained, yeah. you know, shored up. So, you know, that's an example of where you would look for the measurement in how they voted. And, you know, again, it's inexact, and we do the best we can, and we do the most we can, you know, to keep awareness raised on some of the things that are more difficult to break through on.
Uh-huh. And so your Hill conference calls would be important there mm-hmm. in judging success.
Right.
Because you would see votes move. So right. It's more than just are you starting to move the needle on public opinion on something?
Yeah, and you know, at this stage of the game, and we don't pay attention to the polls. I mean, that's one thing the president says all the time that really, you know, filters all the way down. You know, we're not worried about when a poll comes out saying, oh, we've got to do something to combat that poll. I think right now the polls that you're reading about are reflective more than the president than about Washington in general. You know, it's as much about Congress and kind of the whole lot, you know, of inability to get things done in Washington, which is a frustration of the president's and all of us at the White House. There's, you know, the Congress hasn't gotten a whole lot done, so it's measured in different ways, but we uh-huh. just, you know, do as much as we can to move the needle.
But it doesn't, if you're paying attention to polling, it doesn't mean that that you're just going to be just caving in. You can use polling to figure out how something can be sold. Say, for example, in the Clinton administration, Robert Rubin had been very much in favor of helping the Mexican government with supporting the peso, and that was not something that was popular here. But they looked at polling, and they looked at polling in terms of how do they best sell this. They were going to do it, and nothing was going to change them on that. But they wanted to know how to sell it. And so polling, it would seem, have a lot of different uses. And don't you all use it that way as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, I mean, you know, but there's an awareness of it. It does identify, you know, obviously the economy surpassed Iraq at a certain point in terms of what was most on people's minds. You know, there's indicators that you get like that. But I think you also have to remember to you know, look at the fine print and look and see who was polled and when were they polled and how were they polled. You know, and you know, so you can't have it deter you or depart from your principles. The way that you make decisions based on, you know, the thing the president always talks about is decision making has to be based on principles, not popularity. And you can't chase polling, or you can't, you know, but it can inform in a certain way, you know, general awareness or recognition of what's on people's minds.
Yeah, but you know, where does the public come in here? And doesn't in a representative government where the president, just like members of Congress, are representing the public. And does the public have a right between elections to let its views be known?
Of course the public has a right, and those views are heard and taken seriously and factored into the larger equation.
Uh-huh. Okay, why don't we go to some questions. Towson, do you want to start off? Yep.
Yep.
What has been the most difficult policy you've had to work to communicate to the press and the public, and why do you think it was difficult to communicate?
I'm sorry, what was the very first part of your question?
The first part of it? What has been the most difficult policy you've had to work to communicate to the press and to the public?
You know, the immigration thing, for me personally, was probably the toughest and the most frustrating. You know, the president believes really strongly in it. I believe with every bone in my body that one day a lot of the things that the president stands for and that the administration fought for in this comprehensive bill are going to be enacted. And for whatever reason, the political will was not there, including in our own party, to get it done right now. But I think the fact that the president, no Congress, no president will ever again be able to look the other way on this issue. And at some point, the political courage will be there. You know, you saw with the economy this year that the White House and Congress was able to work together to get the stimulus package done really quickly because it was impossible not to. And I think one day we're going to get there in immigration where they're going to have to come together and solve this thing. And so that was one that it just was frustrating because you really believe you're right about something and you know the country would be better off. And the people who said it was amnesty just didn't read it. You know, I mean, it was border security first. There were lots of reasons why it was good for the country, security-wise, in terms of the economy, everything. And one day, it's going to happen, and a lot of the president's elements will be in there. So, I wish we could have gotten it done under our watch, but it was a fascinating thing to try to communicate out.
That's immigration and Social Security have been two issues that have been always very, very difficult to deal with.
Right.
What are some of the different things that you tried?
The big thing with immigration was engaging with bloggers, which really was the first time the White House had done that. We didn't only get engaged with conservatives, but the funny thing about engaging with conservatives on that issue was they were 100% against what we were doing. And there again, we did it fact-based. We would develop a response to a myth that was put, you know, National Review online. And you know, the funny thing was, Rich Lowry, speaking of National Review, told me that he gave us a lot of credit for engaging, you know, with the bloggers, and we actually helped him understand the issue more clearly. And we corrected, you know, these myth fact ideas. You know, we were able to correct some things. Now, we didn't move his position necessarily on the issue of comprehensive immigration reform, but we did at least prevent him from you know, putting out more bad information. So maybe there were other people who we helped through Rich, through what he wrote and what he said on the Fox News channel. But
how did you do it? Was it the same group of emails from Rapid Response?
No, we did it through the Office of Strategic Initiatives, but the person there in OSI drew in large part from our documents that we used out of communications, and it was all done kind of with our buy-in, and I would check off on what we were responding to and what the response was. It was actually a really fun thing to do. The bloggers were shocked at first that they were hearing from the White House. So we've done it a little bit on Colombia Free Trade recently, and I think we need to find ways to do it more. The president did an interview today with Yahoo.com, the first kind of direct-to internet interview that the president's done, solely for the internet. You know, we've done a lot of things that had an internet component to it. So we're wide open to try these other things, and I think engaging with the bloggers, if you're not doing it, you're missing out on a big element of communication strategy in 2008. It's here to stay, and they're powerful and important. And they can have an impact, and you ignore bloggers at your own peril as a communicator.
How do you decide who to respond to?
You know, it's a great question because, you know, the funny thing, because the rules, it is a little sketchy about what the rules are. If it's a guy with a blog in his parents' back bedroom, you know, he doesn't play by any journalistic rules or ethics rules or rules of fairness or responsibility. So you do have to pick your spots a little bit, especially as the White House. And, you know, one of the tricky things with the president doing, you know, kind of engaging in new media is everything the president does really does have to be presidential, you know. So you really do have to, because it's not just, you know, President Bush. It is the office of the president that we're caretakers of. So you do have to pick your spots a little bit. We largely stayed with pretty well-established bloggers, some affiliated with normal media outlets like National Review in that example,
right.
but not exclusively. So it was interesting. It's a developing effort on our part, and it'll evolve in the next 9 months or 10 months we have left. But I think it's been a worthwhile effort.
How many of them? I mean, how many different blogs would you say that
you
dealt with?
I think it was probably a universe on immigration. It was probably 8 to 10. On the Columbia Free Trade, it's been less than that. There again, an issue that doesn't get a lot of kind of general traffic. But we've tried to identify areas where there's been some misinformation and correct it.
One of the things that you've been doing, particularly on, I've seen it in Columbia Free Trade and also on FISA, is that you've brought people into the briefing room.
Right.
That Dana's had people
right.
come in. There were people on Columbia Free Trade who talked about it from various, there were three guys that came in.
Right.
And on FISA, they had somebody from Justice and from National Intelligence
right.
talk about that. And how are the decisions made to bring those people in?
You know, the it really is a, and again, in collaboration with Dana, it's a matter of, here's an expert who can really drill down. The president will talk about this issue, in the at the presidential level, but the reporters are going to have other questions. And it's a way to flesh out the issue. The White House reporters love process stories. And we're also able to bring over reporters that deal with that specific issue. We brought Treasury reporters over, for example, or Justice reporters, an example of FISA. One way I think we've used that tactic pretty effectively is on what we've sort of referred to as the kitchen table issues. We've developed a little format, and this is another example where the communicators can really help kind of in the policy process. Air traffic congestion and all the mayhem that travelers went through last summer became a big, big problem. Obviously, delayed flights, bad for our economy and for productivity, but in a way, just as bad for that mother who missed the family reunion or, the guy who didn't get to the wedding to be the best man or whatever because he sat on the tarmac at LaGuardia for 5 or 6 or 7 hours in some cases, So I heard Secretary Peters in the run-up to the State of the Union, who's the Transportation Secretary, and I think one of the best-kept secrets in town, by the way. She's really, really great. But in the run-up to the State of the Union in 07, she talked a lot about this congestion stuff and what we could do to improve air travel. And ultimately, it did not make it into the State of the Union in 07. And it became an issue that we picked up as sort of a standalone kind of thing throughout the year in 07. Well, she developed a policy process over at Transportation working with the White House that eventually got to the White House where they wanted to be able to do some things so that the summer of 08 would not be a repeat of the summer of 07. So we seized on this as an issue that people care about, and when we start talking about, we're going to try to make air travel for you and your family, better than it was in 07. So we did a deal where she came in and briefed the president in the Oval Office. We brought the pool in, the press pool. The president said a few words about the briefing he had just gotten, and Secretary Peters and Bobby Sturgill, who's the FAA administrator, went to the briefing room, or in some cases we've done that. We did a similar effort with import safety when that first became a big issue with Secretary Levin from HHS. In some cases they'd go to the briefing room, in some cases they would just meet with reporters in small groups or a pen and pad kind of format. In other cases they would just go out to the North Lawn and do interviews with the cable news outlets. But this notion of briefing the president, which sort of endorses that cabinet member, or in the case of Sturgill, the FAA administrator, to talk about this, and then do one-on-one interviews or small group interviews with reporters. So it's not a huge investment for the president, not a big lift for him, but a powerful and has been a successful, I think, way to communicate on some of these issues that are not huge, but they're really important.
But what's interesting is that this year there have been a lot, but prior to that there were not. In the first term, that was just not something that was done. It was very rare for anybody to come into the briefing room. And I'd always wondered why, because it was just, it's automatically a good story because reporters are going to write about what happens in the briefing room and about the issues. And they need information, and they
right.
want information. So what were the, the things that needed to be unplugged before that happened?
You know, when I got to the White House in the summer of 06, I found an open mind for all this kind of stuff. You know, that when I went uh-huh. through the interview process, everybody that I met with kept saying, what new ideas do you have? What do you think we've done wrong? Where do you think we've made mistakes? Press office, same way. You know, Dana Perino has 1,000 ideas a day. I mean, she's incredibly creative. Sometimes, you know, you're unable to execute all the ideas because of the demands of the, you know, the urgency of what happens each day for her as press secretary. But Dana was wide open to it. You know, she brought up, why don't we bring these guys in? It was something that we had done a couple of times. I don't remember the first time that it was done, but I know there was an openness to it. And
Paulson has come in a couple of times.
He's come in a number of times. It's a smart thing to do because sure. you're right. It's a little, something a little bit different and new. They have expertise on the substance of what you're talking about, and it's just a good thing to do. The president's cabinet, you know, is something. I remember when I met with Josh Bolton during the interview process, he said, "How do you think we can better use the cabinet?" You know, again, Mary Peters, when the Minnesota bridge collapse happened. She I forget if she went a day earlier, went with the president, but was there with the president, and then stayed behind and did a lot of media after the president left Minneapolis. She was phenomenal on the subject, both in terms of the empathy and in terms of the substance of the policy and what can be done. You know, there was a lot of concern about infrastructure across the country. Here you have the Department of the Secretary of Transportation able to talk about it. I think it represents the president very well when we're able to do that.
Uh-huh. One of the things that's a little harder to calculate, but also is increased, at least with the president, are the off-the-record sessions
right.
since 2005. He's had a number of off-the-record sessions. And is that true? Like, do you have off-the-record sessions and background sessions with reporters? And what do you find their value is? You can take it for the president and then for yourself as well.
President, you know, the value in doing that with the president is so that the reporters get a little more insight into his thinking, you know. And sometimes he's able to, you know, he's able to just talk a little bit more freely, a little more conversational manner, and just open up a little bit about why he feels that it's not good to go meet one-on-one with Ahmadinejad in Iran, for example, or something like that. And I think it does inform the reporting when they know why the president made a certain kind of decision, and that's the main mm-hmm. reason for doing that. And for personally, you know, again, I'm not dealing with the reporters on the day in and day out breaking news stories like the press office and Dana mm-hmm. and her deputies would be. When the reporters reach out to me more often on the strategy, why are we going to Toledo? You know, if we have a series of speeches, I get asked a lot about the speeches a lot. That's probably the number one thing. Are you going to be making news on Wednesday in St. Louis or whatever? What can you tell me about the thinking going into this reason for this series of speeches or this series of events or what have you? There's some questions now about legacy. When are you going to kick into legacy mode? You know, and so, so I'm able to talk, you know, mostly on background, again, just so they open up a little bit about what we're thinking. I don't talk to reporters every single day. It's something I've had to get. I've gotten used to. Every job I had, I was the one that was on the front lines with reporters, or at least on the, you know, as I kind of grew through the ranks. Not necessarily the first line of defense, but talking to reporters was always a big part of my job. This job a little bit less so, since I'm doing more of the strategic planning and also the management of the process at the White House is another thing that the communications director spends a lot of time on, coordinating with the speech writers, with the event people, with the production people, to make sure that the message is being executed in the way it was supposed to. So that involves, you know, more, you know, meetings and making sure that everybody's lined up on the same page. But, you know, talking to reporters on background, you can't talk to reporters off the record who you don't have history with or you don't know that you can trust them. But these reporters are all at the White House are all, responsible and there's a time and a place for it. I don't do it a lot. But sometimes it's the right thing, you know, to do for various reasons.
Yeah, in looking at management, what are the parts as you see it that you're responsible for, and how do you interact with them? How often as a manager?
You know, every day we after that 8 o'clock meeting that I mentioned earlier with Ed Gillespie at 8:30, I have three deputies and they'll pop in for a few minutes, and we'll talk about just make sure we're lined up because, you know, with the meetings and the different things that I do, sometimes I can be unavailable for a little period of time to them during the day. So I just make sure that we're all connected. And then we have a more formal meeting that we've just started on Friday mornings just to kind of look to the week ahead. So regular with them. And, you know, my day is divided up. You know, like Jeannie Mama, who I mentioned, runs the media affairs operation, and Terry on the with the communications policy staff. They don't need a lot of micromanaging or hand-holding. It's more kind of guidance and direction. So the management of them and their staffs is not something that's burdensome or that I have to spend a lot of time on. Same with Adam and the production team. It's more a matter of reflecting for them what's important to the president, what's the president thinking about a certain issue. And also, as we decide the president's calendar, what kind of events we're going to do, making sure that from an execution standpoint, that our team in communications knows what's expected and kind of why we're doing it, you know, what the goal is, what we want to accomplish so that they can execute.
Uh-huh. Do you all have a question? Yeah.
First of all, thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
My question is about the media, pertaining to the media. I work for a media outlet that covers the Hill and the White House and the Pentagon. And my question is, do you feel or is there a sense within the White House fighting for coverage because of the presidential election coming up? It's plastered all over the media every day. Do you feel a sense that you have to kind of fight for airtime to get your message or your stories across, fighting against the
right
stories about Obama and Clinton and McCain?
A couple things. First of all, it's the 08 campaign, and it's also the budget cutbacks at the media outlets, because there are fewer reporters than there used to be. In many cases, there are fewer producers. You know, the Washington bureaus have yeah. tightened up, so there are less resources at the media outlets, and obviously 08 is commanding the public's attention earlier than usual, and in a way that it's exciting from the standpoint of engaging people in the political process. We totally get it, understand it, but I think the lesson to be learned from our standpoint at the White House is, you know, at certain points in a president's term, you know, you have kind of a regular an event in the East Room. You've seen a million of them, Martha. Mm-hmm. There's not news. The president's talking about, you know, energy with a group of students or something who are being recognized for, you know, mm-hmm. some reason. Well, those events that are not newsworthy just don't get covered at all anymore. You know, in part because we're in the eighth year, in part because of the headwinds that we face with the campaign, in part because of the resources. But mostly we have to really be on the lookout for we have to be really vigilant in terms of making sure that the events that we put on the president's calendar are good use of his time because of this point you raised. Those kind of events are not going to get the sort of mm-hmm. coverage. Some of them will get regional coverage, but that can be accomplished with a photo op or in other ways. So we're mindful of being of the need to be newsy. The president can't talk about Colombia. The Colombia free trade thing is a good example. Speaker Pelosi derailed it by coming up with by changing the rules in midstream, and right now it's not coming to the floor. And we continue to fight to try to keep awareness high. This is an event that every editorial page in the country, you know, yeah. agrees with us on, you know, and we think the votes are there to pass it, but for reasons connected to 08 and the unions, she doesn't want to put it on the floor for a vote right now. But as we continue to fight to raise awareness. President, we are aware he cannot say the same thing every single time. We've got to look for new angles and new wrinkles, and I think you'll see that mm-hmm. Coming up. But you're right. I mean, we cannot approach things as business as usual, because in part because of the calendar, you know, the nature of this election cycle, the resources, all those reasons, we have to approach things differently to break through.
Can you tell us how you feel the cuts that are being made in both staff and in resources of news organizations around town? I mean, you can see it. I mean, I can see it in the basement of the press room. I know,
right.
But, you know, I feel it. I hear them. You know, I hear people talk about it. How do you all see it? For example, one thing is that not as many people are traveling.
Not as many people are traveling. I'll tell you, one way we see it is on the regional front where, you know, you know, I'm trying to pick an example. Like, take the Kansas City Star. Mm-hmm. You know, there, however many reporters they used to have in Washington, now they've got one. let's say. Let's use this as a hypothetical. Right. Well, when we have an event at the White House that used to, that has a person from Kansas City meeting with the president, that used to be an automatic. They would come to the event, they'd write a profile or a story about the meeting. You know, we would get coverage. Now, when Jeannie Mamo makes that call to that bureau or to that reporter, that reporter is in West Virginia today, you know, for the primary.
Right.
Because where there used to be two reporters, now there's one. So you see it there. You see it in the with the White House correspondents, you know, as well. And I'll tell you another place you see it. When we had the U.S. Attorney's story that went for many, many months, there was a competition on that story between White House reporters, Justice reporters, and Hill reporters to get on the air for the networks. And so, you know, only one of them was going to get on the air with that story. So I know Dana and Tony Fratto, who did a great job managing that story from the White House, had to find ways to work with the White House reporter to in a way that was helpful for them, or else they were never going to get on the air. And we see that, we see that competition too,
uh-huh.
You know, between the reporters on the at the outlets on the, you know, on competing beats for the same story.
Do you see the papers themselves change? Like, for example, say the Dayton newspaper. Dayton newspaper has made change. They've cut the size of the paper. I think it made the whole physical size mm-hmm. of it shrunk, both how the layout is. But they also have decided that only stories that are full stories are going to be in the front page. No jump. Nothing goes to a jump. So how does that affect you all as trying to get something in a local paper?
You know, well, this is true with everything now. You guys are studying this stuff at the most exciting time in history, probably.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe since the printing press was invented, you know, because things are changing at light speed. And things like that decision, you know, when I was at NBC, one of the things that I saw a presentation on one time from a research guru in the television industry, guys your age are changing the rules for the networks. And for example, you know, NBC is still into the, and I don't blame them, but Thursday night comedy block, you know, The Office, 30 Rock, and My Name is Earl, or whatever, Scrubs, whatever else they have now in that block. Well, the fast approaching, because of people like you in this room and you guys at Towson, you know, the era of, I want to, you know, destination viewing, you know, Seinfeld was, you know, 8:30 or whatever it was, 8 o'clock, Friends was 8 o'clock on Thursday night. Those days are over. People your age, you know, you're going to watch that show when you want to watch it, not when some guy at NBC decides you're going to watch it. And mm-hmm. this is trickling down to the print. Obviously, they're uh-huh. under enormous pressure. You know, a fascinating thing, when last season, I'm watching Desperate Housewives on a Sunday night on ABC, and Desperate Housewives is ending, you know, it's 5 minutes to 10, and Brothers and Sisters, which at the time was in its first year, you know, hot show, Sally Field, you know, Rachel Griffiths, kind of an all-star cast, Calista Flockhart, ABC has thrown a ton, you know, of promotional dollars and energy mm-hmm. behind Brothers and Sisters. Well, at 5 minutes to 10, when they promo Brothers and Sisters is up next, they also say, and if you missed any part of Desperate Housewives, you can go to abc.com right now and watch it in its entirety for free. So I'm sitting there and I'm saying to myself, well, what do you want me to do? Go online and watch Desperate Housewives or watch your new hot show, Brothers and Sisters?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it's you are seeing right now, they don't know at ABC, at least a year ago, they didn't know what they really wanted you to do, go to the website or stay and watch this new show. But what they do know is that you're going to decide how, where, and on what device you watch all these things. You know, I have four kids, two of them college age. To them, they watch The Office online. You know, they watch it on their iPod. They watch it wherever, you know, they download it. They, you know, I've been a TiVo guy for many years now, and I'm the same way now. Like, you know, I don't watch anything live except for sports, you know, and news, you know. And interestingly, I hate watching sports on TiVo because I know somewhere out there this has already happened, and it bothers me. It's supposed to be live, and you know. But what's happening in this? Not to get off on a media TV thing.
Yeah,
the communal experience is gone.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a kid, you know, you watched Mission Impossible at 9 o'clock, you know, on Sunday night with your whole family, or before, you know, Bonanza or Gunsmoke or whatever the, you know, these long, long-running shows. And people talked about it the next day. Friends was that way, you know, for the generation a little bit older than you guys. Everybody at work had to talk about Friends the next day. People changed their plans, you know, and made plans around watching Friends or Seinfeld or whatever your show was. NBC dominated for years on this notion. Right now, guess what? NBC is finishing its fourth year as the last place network. So they were late to the reality game. You know, there's all kinds of reasons why people have lost their jobs over it, you know? You know, so this is a fascinating time to be dealing with the media, both from an entertainment standpoint and a news standpoint. If you don't, switching back to the print media, if you don't go to Julie Mason's blog at the Houston Chronicle website, I would suggest that you go do it. Go check it out tonight. And now, yeah, she covers campaigns as well as the White House, but the Houston Chronicle made a decision a year or more ago now that their White House correspondent was going to be basically a full-time blogger. Mm-hmm. And she writes a column once a week, I guess, for the print edition. It's really entertaining. It's very well done. But that paper made a decision that their White House coverage was going to be largely done, kind of blogger style. And it's called, you know, White House Confidential or...
Yes, right. Yeah.
What is it?
It's Beltway Confidential.
Beltway Confidential. It's really, really good. Yeah, and she does a terrific job with it.
Yeah. But she wasn't here this year. She did last year. She and David Green. And talked about different media. Well, in thinking about that, the communal experience, when Ronald Reagan was president, the press conference was used for that because he had like 40, I think maybe 46 to 49 press conferences, but most of those were nighttime Eastern events, and they were things that people stopped for and listened to what the president had to say, and it's difficult to get that.
Yeah, you know, an address to the nation, which, you know, happens when warranted, is still a big deal. But you know, there again, there are people. You can go on iTunes and subscribe to the podcast to get all the president's speeches. You know, I don't know how many. I think there are decent numbers of people who do it. You can get the radio address. You know, you can get the state of the union. There's a whole State of the Union kind of place at that time of year where you can. So you have people who used to get those press conferences as a communal event in prime time are now listening to it whenever they want to on their iPod. You know, so it really has changed exponentially, you know, and very fast. And the change is not stopped by any means.
What does the president lose in that of no longer having that in the same way?
You know, I think instead of everybody getting the message at exactly the same time, it is spread out over a period of days. And I think you do lose a little something in terms of the multiplier effect and the echo chamber. There are advantages, though, to doing it over a more prolonged period of time. But I think the number one thing that you lose is that everybody doing it at the same time kind of experience.
Mm-hmm. Towson? We're going to take one more from each side here.
I'll give short answers, so maybe we can...
Yeah. Here. Can you see me? You're talking earlier about the importance of rapidly responding to something before it becomes conventional wisdom.
Right.
We were just talking about, you know, the state of the media right now. I was just wondering if, considering how fast information is disseminated, especially with the internet and advances in media, has there ever been a situation where you think that the damage is kind of irreversible or it's too late before you get to something to try to have them effective? It's kind of damaged the president's reputation permanently or...
You know,
like
we run into that more on things that are older, like the president doesn't believe in climate change. You know, he gave a big speech in the Rose Garden in June of 2002, you know, on the science involved and you know, what he believed about climate change. And still, in 2006, we were still reminding people that he's been talking about this for 2002. So I think there are certain issues that get assigned to people, you know, that can be... Uh-huh. Difficult to overcome, and I think in our case, climate was an example of that.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a question here?
You mentioned talking about the legacy, and eventually the president will get into legacy mode. What will be this president's legacy with, you know, his numbers are as low as they've ever gotten for any president? You have the issues with, you know, the positives with Africa, with AIDS, but then now you're fighting with the supplemental that will be coming out within the next 2 days on the Hill.
No,
so
it's a great question. The president's legacy is Iraq, period. You know, there are lots of other things that we can go through. The president knows that his legacy is Iraq. And he also knows that 30, 40, 50 years from now, because he took an unpopular but principled stand to protect us, keep us safe, my kids, grandkids, your kids, grandkids, that those people who study this 30, 40, 50 years from now are going to say, thank God those guys were willing to take this stand. And how could they almost have you know, how could they have missed it if we wouldn't have taken the stand? And I think when you look back across the sweep of history, you know, you have to take the long view. This is a president that is willing to take the long view. He takes it comfortably, and he knows that, you know, it was unpopular, fully understands why it was unpopular, and then the other things of the president's legacy that, you know, will be secondary to that, you know, there's some domestic issues, the prescription drug benefit, 90 million seniors or whatever the number is now with prescription drugs, you know, No Child Left Behind, very controversial, the unions don't like it, there's a group of teachers that don't want to be held accountable for teaching all kids. This president was willing to say for the disabled kids and the poor kids and the black kids and the Hispanic kids, somebody's got to be held accountable for making sure that they get taught to read and write on grade level. A bold stance, a bipartisan effort that eventually ran into headwinds, mostly based on politics and partisanship related to union endorsements, which is why probably why that law was not reauthorized in an election year. And there's other things I could name, but you know, it'll be around a rock and it'll be not resolved for many, many years.
Uh-huh.
Can we want to try to squeeze in
sure.
one more from either?
Yeah, okay, Towson?
All right, anybody here have one more?
Going back to one of your earlier discussions, do you think that instead of having the president as a talking head, you might have the president, along with other information, you know, taking advantage of the internet in the future as a way of getting the message across?
We've done it in the briefing room with the press secretary.
Like you were mentioning for Africa.
Right. I think we've done it in the briefing room with charts and graphs and images behind. Tony Snow did it more than Dana has done it. Dana has done it a few times. Now, Tony did it effectively with Iraq in terms of when the news started to get better, he was able to put up, approach it more in a multimedia way. A little trickier for the president, although there are times like Africa where we used the most powerful elements of that trip were the images. You know, these people on the roadside with signs saying, you know, thank you, USA, you know, things like that. So I think, you know, again, it's going to evolve. You got to do it in a way that's still presidential. I happen to think a PowerPoint presentation is not presidential. You know, the marketing director at fill-in-the-blank company gets up with a PowerPoint presentation and says, you know, here's the latest, you know, sales figures. I don't know if that is, I think that's more of a cabinet level and a senior staff level kind of a, because you know, some people have suggested, well, why don't you have the president do a PowerPoint on how he feels about, you know, whether climate change or whatever the issue is. Yeah, so I think you have to look for ways to tap into new media, like the Yahoo.com interview today that'll be cut up into 90 seconds. It already is. It went on at 5 p.m. I haven't seen it yet because I was finishing up some things before coming over here. I think that was a smart thing for us to do, and we'll look to do more of those kind of things.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks for asking me back.